made it clear that that is not the case. During a joint press conference with his Iranian counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov ended speculations about Russian demands regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Russian foreign minister made it clear that Moscow has received written guarantees from Washington that Western sanctions will not prevent cooperation within the framework of the Iran deal. He noted that no illegal sanctions can stop the growth of Iran-Russia ties. The top Russian diplomat stressed that Moscow wants a quick revival of the JCPOA, and the Americans must return to the agreement and lift their illegal sanctions. The ball now seems to be in America's court if it is serious about reviving the JCPOA. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong. But Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem.
So one of the things that we have to be very concerned about is that the U.S. Unwillingness to agree that they will never leave the deal and resume coercive sanctions means that it is very likely that if another U.S. administration is elected, especially a Republican one that is more hawkish on foreign policy, and more closely aligned with Israel, that they will leave the deal and reimpose sanctions on Iran. And one must be made very well aware of the fact that the Zionist lobby in the United States is extremely powerful.
Observers believe that the United States, as the party that abandoned the deal and threw the JCPOA in tatters, is expected to do more now that the negotiations have reached this critical stage. The coming days will probably show whether Washington will take the necessary political decisions.
Major cyber attack has hit websites of different institutions in Israel. A number of websites, including the website of the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Military Affairs, were affected. Israeli officials say the ministries of health, welfare were also targeted, as well as the Prime Minister's office. Sources have described the incident as the largest ever cyber attack carried out against Israel.
If what goes around comes around, and after all these years of attacking other people's systems, computer systems, now the Israelis are suffering their own attack.
Internet access advocacy group NetBlox said a significant disruption has been registered on multiple networks supplied by Israel's leading internet providers. There were reports of connectivity interruption across Israel. As of this hour, all the sites are back for activity.
Yeah, it's obvious. Everybody depends on computers now. The problem here is always going to be the problem with irregular warfare. How do you know who did it? Normally what would happen in a moment like this is that Israel would immediately accuse Iran of doing it, no matter who did it. And then they would call for the United States to bomb Iran, invade Iran, overthrow the government, and so on and so forth. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And now you're seeing, I think, the limits of this cyber warfare because it depends on political considerations.
Earlier this year, a hacker group called Moses Staff struck Israeli closed-circuit television cameras in the occupied Palestinian territories and Rafael Advanced Defense System, which is an Israeli military technology company. The group released the images that were apparently taken from CCTV cameras belonging to Rafael Advanced Defense Systems on January 28th in 2021. The group said it had hacked into the closed-circuit television cameras on the streets of the occupied Palestinian territories. back then. It posted a message regarding the cyber attack on its website, titled, "We See With Your Eyes." In November 2021, Moses' staff announced that it had targeted a number of Israeli firms and acquired a vast trove of critical facilities maps, which included information on the location and characteristics of vital systems across the occupied territories. Moses' staff added that the data included airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and 3-dimensional images of Israeli military sites and important buildings. Moses' staff further stated that the information it had was of immense significance. The group has hacked over 165 servers and 254 websites and compiled over 11 terabytes of data, including Israel Post, the Ministry of Military Affairs, files related to Gantz.
Yes, obviously, if the attack succeeded, they have stronger capabilities. That's obvious. But the bigger question is, who would it be? How are we going to deduce this from the evidence? The logical suspect would be Iran, because Iran has already suffered from numerous Israeli attacks. The Israelis even made a movie about it, a miniseries called Tehran, which is all about hacking the Iranian computer system.
The Electron Silag Company and Epsilor Company. Israel has been the source of tension in the Middle East region for decades. It has carried out numerous assassinations in different countries, including Iran. It's also responsible for actual physical attacks on Iran's nuclear sites. Iran has always stressed that Israel's crimes and attacks will not go unpunished, and the cyber field appears to be a new arena for this fight.
On Sunday, Saudi Arabia executed 81 men over terrorism-related charges. It's the largest mass execution the country has so far carried out on record. The figure exceeded the country's total death sentences it handed down last year. Of the 81 people, 73 were Saudi citizens, 7 were Yemeni, and 1 was a Syrian national. More than half of those executed were Shia Muslims, including teenagers from the Recife Qatif region. The convicts also included members of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. They were accused of having links to Daesh and Al-Qaeda terror groups, but documents verifying the charges are yet to be made public.
Look, in the past, it's been quite clear over a number of years that the kingdom is in no way averse to executing people without what under Sharia would count as due process, and in particular targeting individuals because of the beliefs they hold.
The announcement drew widespread condemnation from around the world. Rights activists say the prisoners were put to death for nonviolent acts. Advocates are also questioning the validity of the court proceedings and treatment of the inmates. They say some of the trials were held in secret and that the prisoners had been tortured. Saudi Arabia's last mass execution came on January 2, 2016, when the kingdom killed 47 prisoners, including prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Baghir al-Nimr. They, too, were given capital punishment without fair trials. The cleric's only crime was to call for democracy and rally anti-regime protests. The mass execution drew fierce criticism from the international community. Iran has called it an inhumane act that violated basic human rights principles and international law. The Iranian president has slammed Western countries' double standards, as well as the silence and inaction of the self-proclaimed human rights advocates regarding the execution of innocent people. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has also slammed the Saudi execution of inmates as a heinous crime. It accused Riyadh of practicing the ugliest forms of sectarian discrimination. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet condemned the violent act. She said war crimes may have been committed if people were beheaded following court cases that do not offer proper fair trial guarantees. Some experts believe the move to be a muscle flex by Saudi Arabia amid the Russia-Ukraine conflict that is leading to a global energy crisis and has sent the West scrambling to fight alternative sources of oil. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's planned visit to the kingdom can indicate that the West will be forgiving of the country's crimes. As a matter of fact, human rights campaigners are accusing Johnson of trying to trade oil for blood. The same criticisms were leveled against the kingdom after the killing of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the country's consulate in the Turkish city of Istanbul. But no punishment came Saudi Arabia's way.
Well, clearly the kingdom is considered by the United States to be a very special ally. And in that regard, the priorities the Americans have in dealing with the kingdom relate to basically the massive oil reserves, which are still at Saudi Arabia's disposal. But there can be no doubt that the West and the news media generally, even though there's been some coverage of this story, is dealing with it in a very hypocritical manner.
Reports of mistreatment of prisoners in Saudi jails also abound. Without seeing proper consequences, the kingdom isn't likely to change course in the foreseeable future.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Welcome, dear audience. This is Youth Station.
And you are listening to IRB English Radio.
Today we're going to discuss about a situation where all of us, you know, sometime in our life come across to this.
Or maybe many times.
Yeah,
because
maybe
we're
many
living
times.
In a modern age, then everything is possible to happen many times a day, even.
Yeah, and all the people, like, you know, who are living apart from their families in different countries.
That's very true, yes.
Like, for me, I'm living in the Hausa. So, like, you know, I'm away from my family. So, you know, these situations, and we are talking about being alone.
Mm-hmm.
So that...
And feeling lonely.
Feeling lonely. So, like, when you, these are two different words.
Exactly.
Alone and lonely.
Mm-hmm.
So, alone is more like a situation.
In which physically you're alone.
Yeah, you're physically alone. You have,
Nobody's around you.
No one's around you, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But being lonely, it's more like a feeling.
Yes.
You know, that
something from the inside.
Something from the inside. And that feeling
This is the one that happens most of the time.
Yeah, that feeling is really emotional. You know, you feel it many a times, and that's a bad feeling. You really need someone.
I think as a human being, this feeling happens a lot.
You know, what's the reason for that? Human is a social animal.
Yes.
Human has to interact with others.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at some stage of his life.
Yes.
When no one's around him, like, or he is not interacting with someone.
You know, it's not just about other people being around you. Sometimes you're in a crowd and you're feeling lonely.
That's a good point, yeah.
And I think that comes as an internal thing that has been sticked to you. It's
mm-hmm.
a part of you. Because again, as human beings, since we're going to die, after all, eventually, it's going to
yeah.
be death, which is going to be the end of this journey,
mm-hmm.
of course, and the start of another. But then we're going to be alone. So at the end of the day, we come to the conclusion that if we consider these things as
yeah.
related to each other, then I would sometimes, some moments in my life, I might contemplate and I would say, well, after all, I'm a lonesome.
Yeah.
After all, I'm going to be a lonesome and I'm a a lonely traveler.
Yeah.
It's true, I have a family, I have friends, I have many people around me, but...
Are you talking about the final destination?
Yes. The end of the story.
Yeah.
The finalement.
Yeah, it's going to be you and your journey.
So, this makes me feel like I'm lonesome. The feeling of being lonely happens a lot to a human being. And it's normal, I think, because at the end of the day, as I told you, we are lonesome people.
If you see it this way, like, there are many people who are alone, but they're not lonely.
Yes.
And the other way around, like vice versa. There are many people who are alone, but they are also lonely.
They keep themselves engaged in different things, so they don't feel alone, but they are... Yeah. They don't feel lonely, but they are alone.
Yeah, the people, they're not alone, but they're lonely.
Yes.
Like alone, like, you know, you're
we're
living in a country
through too much of alone and alone.
Yeah, like, you know, if you're living in a country with so many people around you.
Yes.
But suddenly you don't have a friend. I guess there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, like, poor is a person who does not have any friends.
Yes.
So, like, family and friends is the important factors that takes your loneliness away.
Exactly. The distractions of the truth in the world.
Yeah, so...
That's how we've been engaged in this world, you know? Through having a family, through having children, we're going to be tested, and also our lonesome is going to be relieved.
Yeah, may Allah bless all our friends and...
Yes, of course.
The friend of friends for human, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Most High.
The best friend ever.
The best friend ever.
He would never turn against you.
Exactly.
He would never leave you. Let's go for a little break and then we'll be back. Thank you for listening to us and giving your ears and attention.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
That's the thing, right? Like, you know, people don't make Allah their friend. Or they don't consider Him as their friend.
Why? Why do you think that thing happens?
They don't really understand the concept of making Allah their friend. Like, what does it mean to make Allah your friend? That's the reason... When you understand, like, what does it mean by making Allah your friend?
Again, I would point my finger to the modern age. I would say that there are many engaging things that involve you in, but then truly you lose the track of your life. You lose the track of the truth that tells you where you have came from and where you are headed to.
Yeah.
So this is the thing, I think... But people nowadays are so much involved in making money, in running a family. You know, it's very difficult these days. And these things take you away from the real things that you belong to, the real feelings that you should have.
Yeah.
A time to think about yourself, to consider Allah, to speak to Him, to have a chit-chat with Him.
Yeah, that's right. Like, people are not aware of the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Like, there's a hadith, right, in narration. You know, Allah's love is more than that of 70 mothers.
Yes.
We all know what a mother's love is. Like, just 70 times of it is the love of Allah.
Yes. Sometimes when I was younger, I used to say, well, there's no extreme to a mother's love. Then how could I imagine? How kind could God be?
Exactly. Like, if he, you know, get to know more about this, like, anyone can certainly make Allah his friend.
Well, a mother's kindness is a ray of His kindness. Now, just imagine the source of that kindness, how it would be.
Love
then it would leave no place for feeling lonely.
Let's discuss about what can we do when someone's feeling lonely. When, like, for me, if I talk about my personal situation, what can we do?
Yes.
Yeah, if you're feeling lonely. So, like, when I came here to study, I was alone. Like, alone in the sense, like, I knew no one here.
Yes.
So I had no friends, I had no relatives over here. So, like, this way I was alone. But I became lonely at the stage when there used to be any Eid or any festivals.
Because
you know, all the time, you know, it was just normal for me. I was studying,
yes.
I was going to my classes. But lonely, I became at the stage when there used to be any festival.
When you
any,
had no any, busyness.
Yeah. When there used to be any special occasion,
yeah.
whereas in our religion, you know, all the family members, they gather, they yes. have a feast.
Yes.
So
yes.
these times, I used to feel lonely.
Yes, it's very normal because at those times you had more time to think.
Yeah, that day you remember your family very much.
The
you remember
reason
your mother.
Of our all miserable thing, I yeah. think, is thinking.
Yeah, that day I was
when
really remembering my
thinking,
mom, like, love you, mom.
Everything turns to be.
So, what can we do over here?
So you're just saying it. We have to keep ourselves engaged. We have to do things.
Yeah, so that day I called my mom. It was Eid al-Fitr, like right after Ramadan. So like, I was just controlling my tears that day. And so, like my mom's kind of sensitive. So if I cry, like she will start
yes,
crying more than me.
Yes, break yeah. into yeah,
she will cry
well.
More than me. So but these situations... like, the, you know, the first option, where your option is just mm-hmm. visit your family.
Yes, visit your family.
Yeah, and if you cannot...
Go out with your friends.
Yeah, just go out with your friends and, like, the different, there might be different ways.
Yes, everyone has got their own special habits of how to control the lonesome or the feeling of feeling lonely. So for everyone, it differs. I usually do different things and stuff myself with mm-hmm. pile of... new things and
like
tasks.
To keep yourself busy.
Yes, keep myself busy, read a book, go for, I don't know, different things that keep my brain and mind mm-hmm. away from the thought of being lonely.
Yeah, that's a good way to, you know, avoid loneliness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one more thing to add on in my story, like where I said, like on the day of Eid, I was feeling really lonely. So what I did after that, so first I called my mom and I spoke to them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas because that time I couldn't visit my family. So the best way, like one more thing, like take refuge to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Exactly.
And just take refuge.
And since we're living in Qom, we're lucky enough to have a shrine. Then whenever we feel lonely,
exactly.
we go there. And everything
that time,
is just faded away.
That time I was luckily in Mashhad, so I went to the shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam.
That's very
So, you know,
good.
That was, you know, a really, you know, someone, it was like someone put a hand on my chest, like to
you
release
feel it.
Me,
you
to relieve
truly
me.
Feel it, that they are yeah. looking after you. They are watching over you.
So that was a great relief over there.
Mm-hmm. So whenever you feel lonely, just don't feel like you are the only person who is feeling this emotion. It happens to everyone. It's pretty much normal and natural of human beings. But then you can find refuge in Allah. He's always there for you. You can speak to Him. And trust me, when you start speaking to Him or reciting some special supplications or du'as, you would feel like He's there and you would feel that He's accompanying you.
Right. You know, most of the times what happens is sometimes you feel lonely
mm-hmm.
and sometimes you're left alone.
Uh-huh.
Like people leaving you.
This one is so sad.
Yeah, like it's a different
and so heartbreaking.
Important factor. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, like people leave you alone. Like, you know, we see like many occasions.
Yes.
And as we're recording this show in near to the Safar of Imam Hussein, when Imam Hussein left Medina
uh-huh.
and he was heading towards Karbala. And you know, all the, you know, the story that happened, like if you talk about Hadrat Muslim, alayhi salam, like how he was left alone in the Kufa. Like uh-huh, when he
yes,
went to Kufa, there were thousands of people, you know, who were supporting him. When they saw the enemy, they left him alone.
That is the feeling of loneliness.
Yeah, that's, you know, when no one's there to help you, like everyone just, you know, you had someone, but again they left you.
Yes.
Like, you know, that's
Which
a major,
so
you know, sad feeling.
A very much sad feeling.
You know, this happens because sometimes, you know, due to the fear of the enemy, mm-hmm. due to the fear of the consequences.
Yes.
When your ultimate goal is not Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Exactly.
You
we
just
should consider
leave the
that point as well.
Of haq, mm-hmm. path of truth.
Exactly. They left him alone when he was in need of help.
Yeah. So I guess this was all the time we had. So we all need to search a good friend, and may we all be good friends with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes, he would be always there for you. So trust him, and whenever you feel lonely, just go to him. He would never let you down. Thank you for listening. It was a pleasure to be with you once more. Until another session, I leave you to the protection of God.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Gazan farmers fear a season of ruined crops and the long-term consequences of the Zionist regime's ongoing practice, says Maho Hosseini, writer, in an article titled "Zionist Regime Carries Out Aerial Spraying of Herbicides Near Palestinian Farmlands." Stay tuned for more. For 4 days in a row, the Zionist regime crop duster planes have been flying near the eastern Gaza Strip, spraying chemicals believed to be herbicides in close to Palestinian lands adjacent to the border fence. The frequency of the spray is determined by the direction of the wind. Eyewitnesses say, adding that the spray stops when it rains or when the wind blows in the opposite direction. The only start to spraying along the border fence when the wind blows west in the direction of the Palestinian lands in order to allow the herbicides to cover a larger area inside our lands, Palestinian farmer Yusuf Abu Maqadi told Middle East Eye recently, adding, but when the wind starts blowing east, they immediately stop because it would harm them. In Gaza, around 40,000 Palestinians depend on farming as their only source of livelihood. Maqadi estimates that the latest spraying was conducted over at least 60 hectares of farmland, directly affecting the livelihood of 35 to 40 farmers. The Zionist regime army regularly claims that the herbicides are used to clear vegetation in the buffer zone in Gaza side of the fence in order to have a clearer view of the area for military purposes. But Palestinians say the policy inflicts wide-ranging damage on the residents of Gaza. Maqadi accused the Zionist regime authorities of intentionally damaging Palestinian crops in the eastern farmlands using various tactics over the years. He said, "We have been going through the same scenario for years now. Every couple of weeks, they send drones to spray our lands to damage the crops so that they can monitor the area more clearly. Sometimes this happens only a few days before the harvest season. You can imagine the amount of losses we endure." Aside from the spraying of herbicides, Palestinian farmers also have to deal with the constant firing of tear gas by the Zionist regime forces deployed along the border fence in eastern Gaza. Maqadi said, just today alone, the Zionist regime forces fired more than 10 tear gas canisters at shepherds to keep them away from the buffer zone. But the wind blows the gas towards us and we have to leave our land several times a day to avoid inhaling it. This happens on a daily basis and several times a day. According to rights groups, the Zionist regime has been conducting aerial herbicide spraying in this area for several years, and the activity is typically carried out without prior notification or warning to Palestinian farmers. The Zionist regime carries out the spraying when the wind is blowing westward, which transports the chemicals deep into Gaza, reaching distances as far as 1,200 meters into the strip, activists say. Since 2014, the clearing and bulldozing of agricultural and residential lands by the Zionist regime military close to the eastern border of Gaza has been completed by unannounced aerial spraying of crop-killing herbicides, the research group Forensic Architecture found in 2019. The London-based agency spent over a year examining the environmental and legal implications of the Zionist regime practice of aerial spraying of herbicides along the Gaza border. The agency said in a statement, "This ongoing practice has not only destroyed entire swathes of formerly arable land along the border fence, but also crops and farmlands hundreds of meters deep into the Palestinian territory, resulting in the loss of livelihoods for Gazan farmers." Farmers would not see the full scope of damage caused by herbicides until days or weeks after the spraying activity, said Iyad Abu Qalba. "We still cannot determine if the spraying has incurred any damage to the crops. It usually takes up to 8 to 10 days until dark spots start appearing on the leaves. And this is when we know that they are damaged and cannot be harvested," the local farmer told MEE. "We are supposed to harvest the crops, including peppers, courgettes, and wheat, in the next 2 or 3 months. If the herbicides have indeed affected the crops, which we will know in around a week, then the whole season is ruined and tens of thousands of dollars are lost, a Bogle boss said. As a result, many farmers are facing increasing debts due to the Zionist regime's continuous practice aimed at damaging Palestinian crops, Abu Ghalba added. The situation worsened when the Zionist regime attacked Gaza in May 2021, leading to an estimated loss of $204 million in Gaza's agricultural sector, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture. Abu Ghalba said, "We are still struggling with the consequences of the last attack on Gaza that causes us huge damage due to the shelling and leveling of lands, as well as abandoning the crops throughout the 11 days of the attack and then having to deal with the Zionist regime's decision to close the borders and prevent exports. We are not ready for another year in which our agricultural lands are targeted continuously."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, the recommended features of dining table. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the recommended features of the dining table. And today we will talk about the sitting position of a person, that a person, how he must sit when he is at the dining table. What we can see in the Islamic teachings is that a person who is sitting on the dining table, especially from the Prophet, it is said to sit on the left foot, that he must sit on the left foot. And this is something that shows the humility and the modesty of a person. This is when a person is about to sit on the dining table and he wants to eat. This way he is showing his modesty and humility. Now, the point here is that at that time, because people used to sit on the floor, that's why they were following these ethics and the rituals and these features that are said by the Prophet. But in today's world, where we are using a table and the chair, now this is also recommended if it is the sign of humility and the modesty. But if it is not the modesty, then obviously it is not recommended. Therefore, we need to be careful about these things, that when it is said in the teachings of Islam, in the lifestyle, that a person should observe it in a way that the way he is sitting at the dining table, he should be in a way that it shows its modesty, it shows its humility. So that thing should be observed in all the times, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the recommended features of dining table, and we were talking about the way of sitting at the dining table. It is said that the Prophet has said that a person who sits on the dining table in order to eat food, he must sit on his left foot. Now, we have many other places where it is recommended to do so. For example, when you're entering the toilet, you must enter with the left foot. Now, why is it left foot? Because scientifically, it is said that if a person at that time will have the heart attack, he will not fall inside the toilet but outside, so someone can come and help them. Also, when you sit on the left foot, it keeps your balance. For example, if someone is out of balance. It will not allow you to go out of balance. Therefore, it is recommended to sit on the left foot. On the other hand, we can see that the main topic which is being seen by the Prophet, the main subject, which was the matter, it was that because at that time people used to sit on the floor and they used to eat next to each other. Therefore, he said it is better, it is recommended to sit on the left foot. On the other hand, when you sit on the earth, you should sit in a way that it should be a state of humility and the state of modesty. If it is something which we have in our lives, then obviously we are living according to the recommendations of the Prophet. And even in today's world, if we are using a chair and we are using a table, we have a dining table and it's a chair. Therefore, if it is not the sign of arrogance, then it is fine to eat there as well. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Nowruz, promise of life. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Today is the 21st of March, corresponding with the 1st of Farvardin, which marks the start of spring and the new Iranian year. In this episode, you will hear some of the signs of Nowruz, which inspire happiness. The earth has got tired of winter and wishes freshness and liveliness. As the spring nears in the northern hemisphere, all plants gradually wake up and put on new clothes. The earth becomes green and flowers fill the air with their sweet fragrances. The inspiring smell of spring is felt everywhere as people are in the hustle to make everything clean and new. A few weeks before Nowruz, people start house cleaning to accompany the nature. They try to buy new clothes for the family members. Streets are busy and there is big boom in businesses. As houses are clean and beautiful, they should have symbols of freshness too. Therefore, most people let wheat or lentil and peas in little plates to have fresh sprouts during Nowruz days. These fresh sprouts will decorate the haftzin tablecloth. Haftzin tablecloth is composed of 7 items which begin with letter S, seen in Farsi. One of these items is called sabze, or fresh sprouts. It symbolizes freshness and greenery. The morning of the 1st of Farvardin is a very beautiful and joyous time. Everyone is happy at the turn of the year. We heard a nice song which was a description of spring and Nowruz. Late Fereydun Pur Reza used to sing simple and intimate songs. As it was said in the previous episode, at the turn of the year, people usually recite this prayer. O transformer of hearts and sights, O administrator of night and day, O changer of the condition and states, change our state to the best state. This prayer is recited in order to appeal to God for granting us the best conditions and blessings. This reminds us that even in happy moments, we should remember God and thank Him for His blessings and ask Him for the best. As the year turns, hearts are filled with hope and motive. This hope motivates us to move for achieving our goals and making of a better future. Nowruz is like a beautiful garment, which the Iranian nation and the nations adhering to Nowruz culture have grown up with. This ancient feast is among the strong elements of the Iranian culture. This feast is celebrated by all ethnicities in Iranians. However, Nowruz is different for young children. It is accompanied by taking gifts from the elderly and wearing new clothes. Nowruz is celebrated by a number of other nations, including Tajikistan, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Afghanistan. It is also marked by minorities in Pakistan, India, and some of the Central Asian countries.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on March 21, 2007, issued a message on the occasion of the Iranian New Year. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. O the Transformer of hearts and eyes. O the Planner of night and day. O the Transmuter of power and circumstances. Change our condition into the best of conditions. O Allah, send blessings on Ali ibn Musa Ridha al-Murtada, the virtuous and immaculate Imam. I extend my felicitations on the occasion of the New Year and Nowruz Festival to all our dear compatriots, and also to all the Iranians throughout the world who live in various parts of the globe, and also to all those nations that celebrate Nowruz Festival. In particular, I offer my congratulations to the esteemed families of our honorable martyrs and to war disabled veterans and their families and to all the devotees and all those who are striving wholeheartedly for the prosperity and progress of the Iranian nation. Nowruz Festival marks the beginning of the freshness of nature and rejuvenation of the world and revitalization of the atmosphere surrounding the everyday lives of human beings. And it will be so good if, along with the freshness of the world, the souls and hearts of human beings are also vitalized and invigorated. The vitality of souls and hearts is attained through the remembrance of Allah, through seeking assistance from the Almighty, and by planting the sapling of benevolence and goodwill for all our brothers and sisters, and for the entire humanity.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Nowruz Festival includes many beauties, in addition to the fact that the Iranian people, wherever they are, remember the Almighty and ask Allah for a basic change in their lives at the turn of the year. One of the most beautiful customs associated with Nowruz Festival is the custom of visiting relatives and friends, which helps to strengthen cordial relations and emotional bonds among members of the society. Now, if we compare this with the national festivals of some other nations, which are accompanied by immoral actions and which do not involve cordial relations or emotional bonds, we will come to realize that the national festival marking the commencement of the new year of the Iranian nation is not only contemporaneous with the spring of nature, which is in itself a merit, but that is also characterized by some noble and philanthropic qualities. Expressing one's heartfelt happiness by smiling and congratulating and welcoming one another, strengthening one's social ties, and adorning one's place of living are among the very good and pleasant traditions which the Iranian people have observed since ancient times. These traditions have all been endorsed by the sacred religion of Islam and by the Islamic canon.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Refugees are welcome here, the most popular chant at today's protest. Thousands gathered outside the BBC over the weekend, disappointed yet again by the way Western governments are treating people fleeing war and persecution.
People here today say that the British population is being brainwashed by a racist, state-funded media. That's probably why today's protest is being held outside the BBC. They want to know why Ukrainian refugees are being welcomed, but refugees from almost anywhere else will soon be branded criminals.
The UK has issued 4,000 visas for Ukrainians with family in Britain, and anyone with a spare room is being offered £350 a month to house those without family here. They can stay for 3 years, they can work, and will have access to public services, including the National Health Service. Meanwhile, the government is pushing through the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill that could see refugees from elsewhere arriving via routes like the English Channel get up to 4 years in prison.
I feel like we're forgetting that other people are still fighting to be like considered as worthy of empathy. And we need to keep thinking about people in Palestine, in Yemen, and, you know, all the previous refugees that came to the UK, for instance, that were not treated as well, like the Syrian refugees. And for me, I think this is what today is about, to remember that we're all humans and we all deserve to be treated the same way.
Protests like these attract people campaigning for various causes, all of them somehow related to the persecution of minorities and racism.
I've been a supporter of Stand Up to Racism for many years. I grew up in apartheid South Africa and left the country because of the apartheid situation and came to England and did my education here. And I am very sympathetic to refugees. I'm appalled that we don't have, as a formerly Christian country in this country, a more open and welcoming view on refugees.
We are not against anti-Semitism. We are against the violent action of being to our kids in Gaza, and we are totally supporting Jewish people, and we are totally supporting anyone who is decent to others and peaceful to others.
Before hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees mobilized, the UK insisted its public services are at breaking point. Tabloid newspapers encouraged millions to vote for Brexit in 2016, creating the illusion that Britain was being overrun by foreigners. But the media is now sending a very different message. It seems the NHS can cope, and Ukrainian refugees will not be taking any British jobs. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United States and its key ally, the UK, launched the Iraq War in 2003 with a strike against a location where then-Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and his top commanders were believed to be meeting. But that was not an abrupt attack, as Washington and London had already begun intensifying their military build-ups in the Persian Gulf beforehand. U.S. President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair repeatedly indicated that the assault was imminent and aimed to destroy Saddam's weapons of mass destruction program. But neither UN inspectors nor intelligence services could ever find such weapons in Iraq.
None of those pretexts were really help us explain the overall project that the U.S. had in this region.
Ironically, Washington and London gave little heed to calls to